economy is doing much better. And we've had a lot of discussion about the different plans.
Senate leaders in the state legislature say they're hopeful as the session begins. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Congressman Don Young makes the case for reinstating earmarks.
What are we here for if we can't represent the people that are going to vote for?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station.
The U.S. House is pondering whether to reinstate the use of earmarks, where lawmakers direct federal money to specific projects, usually in their home districts. One of the biggest proponents at a committee hearing today was Alaska Congressman Don Young.
This, to me, is one of the crucial issues to this Congress, the next Congress, and this House.
He and other earmark proponents say Congress functioned better with earmarks to foster compromise. They say when members get their projects in a spending bill, they have a stake in seeing that bill pass. Earmarks, they say, help prevent gridlock. Young says all earmarks are projects requested by their constituents.
What are we here for if we can't represent the people that are going to vote for?
But to some, the carve-outs reek of pork barrel spending. The poster child in 2005 was one of Young's earmarks, more than $200 million for the Gravina Island Bridge, the so-called Bridge to Nowhere. After that became a national laughingstock, Republicans in Congress banned earmarking. Young, though, says without them, Congress is turning the money over to the administration and letting bureaucrats decide where it goes. Democratic Whip Steny Hoyer is with Young on this issue, but some of Young's fellow Republicans, like Representative Mark Walker of North Carolina, say earmarks look wasteful.
Effective conservatism requires the right policy, the right message, and the right voice.
Some lawmakers suggest allowing the practice again, but delaying the effective date until next year, so it doesn't look like incumbents are trying to give themselves an election year trophy. Alaska Senate Republican leaders are pointing to rising oil prices as confirmation that their reticence to a proposed income tax was right. But the chamber's leading Democrat says relying on oil gains would be short-sighted. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman spoke with the leaders about their hopes for the session.
Fairbanks Republican Senate President Pete Kelly says his caucus was right to oppose an income tax last year.
The people who were so motivated to put a tax in did it in an environment of $26 per barrel oil. Frankly, it's hard to blame them for reacting the way they did. I'm glad that the Senate held back and was a little more disciplined on that, because we would now be pulling hundreds of millions of dollars out of an economy that's trying to recover.
The price for North Slope oil was $69 per barrel on Tuesday. Kelly expects the Senate majority to oppose Governor Bill Walker's proposal for a 1.5% tax on income from employment to pay for maintenance that's been deferred for state facilities. Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner says a broad-based tax is still needed.
I hope Alaskans are getting very angry about failure to take the necessary steps to pull ourselves out of this recession and this trouble.
Gardner says the future of Alaska permanent fund dividends is in jeopardy if the state doesn't have a broad-based tax like an income tax. It's a position that Kelly completely rejects. He says putting downward pressure on the budget and drawing from permanent fund earnings will stabilize the budget.
I'm hopeful. Again, the economy is doing much better. And we've had a lot of discussion about the different plans. The Senate plan, I think we're finally gaining acceptance of it by some of the people in the administration and even some of the people over in the House Democrat side.
The Senate plan would draw roughly 5% of the value of the permanent fund annually from fund earnings. The plan the House passed last year is similar, but also includes a tax that would close the budget gap. Kelly says adopting the Senate plan would help the state.
Well, I think it's going to be proven over time that we don't need that broad-based tax, that the economy is recovering, oil prices are recovering, production is recovering, and we can go to the earnings reserve to pay a dividend and to pay a portion of government. And that, I think we have the facts on our side, and I would hope they would be convinced by them at the end of session.
While Gardner says she supports an income tax that requires those with higher incomes to pay more, she doesn't back Walker's employment tax. That tax would limit payments to twice the amount of the PFD.
I appreciate his effort to try to craft something that might bring the Senate to the table. I don't think that this is going to fly.
Gardner says the idea of exploring for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge won't answer the budget problem.
Alaskans need to understand that this is not going to be the perfect solution for us. We've got a couple of decades, if then, before there's any revenue to the state, and most of this is not on state land, so we're not going to get much.
Walker transmitted his budget bills to the legislature on Wednesday. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
An Alaska state lawmaker has skipped required training to prevent sexual and other harassment after her calls for a third-party review of how allegations of inappropriate behavior by a former lawmaker were handled went unheeded. Republican Representative Tammy Wilson says she'll await any potential consequences. House and Senate leaders told lawmakers and staff they would be required to attend. Those who do not could face an ethics complaint. There also has been a threat, at least on the House side, that lawmakers who do not comply could lose staff. Today, legislators filed into a gymnasium for training amid a renewed focus on sexual harassment and misconduct nationally. A state-ordered review of thousands of oil wells on the North Slope is complete, following a multi-day oil and gas leak at one of BP's facilities last spring. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission found no additional wells that could lead to a similar accident, according to Commissioner Kathy Forrester. The state ordered the review of all North Slope oil wells after BP's internal investigation found five of its producing wells had a similar design to the one that failed. The failure happened after thawing permafrost put uneven pressure on the well, causing the wellhead to shoot up and knock off a valve, which then spewed oil and gas. Forrester says the permafrost thaw was unrelated to climate change and was caused by the heat of the oil being recovered. Forrester says the commission is changing its regulations to prohibit companies from using the well design related to the accident. Last April, Alaska's Gasline Development Corporation filed a formal application asking for federal permits to build a project to export natural gas from the North Slope. In its current form, the Alaska Gasline project includes an 800-mile pipeline from the North Slope to a facility in Nikiski. That's the route project managers settled on in 2013. But part of the federal permitting process for the Alaska LNG project includes analyzing possible alternative routes. And some Alaska communities are asking the federal government to do just that. Last week, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough asked the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for permission to intervene in the permitting process. It also filed a formal complaint with the commission, arguing that it wasn't properly studied as an alternative site to Nikiski. This is the second time a group has asked to weigh in on the permitting process. In 2017, a group in Valdez told the Federal Commission that a route to its city would save the state money and reduce the environmental impact of the project. Jesse Carlstrom, a spokesperson from the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, says that it has reviewed the possibility of routing the project to Valdez at the Federal Commission's request. He says the corporation has not yet discussed the Matanuska-Susitna Borough's request. Federal regulators could choose an alternative route to one the state prefers. The state is on a tight deadline to get this project permitted and built. It wants to get shovels in the ground in 2019 and bring the pipeline online by 2025. Corporation President Keith Meyer has said in the past that the project could be delayed by years if the state has to switch the pipeline route. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new program offers promise for reducing emergency calls at an Anchorage homeless facility.
Any day you have zero calls for service at that location is a miracle.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Subsistence Board is accepting applications through February 2nd to fill seats on the 10 Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. Councils meet at least twice a year and provide critical advice to the board on subsistence management issues. Individuals may apply or nominate someone for membership. More at doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456. This message is sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Officials in Anchorage say a new pilot program has radically cut down the emergency calls from the area surrounding the city's main homeless shelter. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports that at a meeting on homelessness today, the program's apparent success took many elected leaders by surprise.
Since January 2nd, the city's homeless coordinator has been spearheading a pilot program at the campus connecting Beans Cafe and the Brother Francis Shelter. They've had mental health professionals on site, along with paramedics and police, clearing people from the area if they aren't utilizing shelter resources. The effect has been a dramatic drop in the number of calls for service to emergency responders. Assemblymember Christopher Constant represents the district encompassing the area and says the program is an attempt to figure out how to make the environment safer for clients and staff alike.
They have secured access after 6 p.m. You can't just come on and drive on or walk on and start dealing drugs or alcohol, like has been the case in the past, and in fact, you can't be using drugs outside on the campus. And they're making people go inside when the shelter opens. You got to go inside. You can't just hang out. And so you got to avail yourself of the services available, or you got to go somewhere else.
Constant has long been critical of how the city's social services for the most needy residents are clustered in certain areas, most of which fall within the neighborhoods in his downtown district. But this, he says, appears to be working extremely well so far. The area will sometimes generate dozens of calls a day to police and paramedics for health emergencies, fights, and other problems. According to an official with the police department, on a recent weekend, APD received just 7 calls for service. And they foresee a dramatic reduction in the demand for overstretched emergency services if the programs are adopted long term. Constant says he regularly drives through the area at night and says far fewer people are on the street. In recent years, thousands of emergency calls a year were reported from the campus, and he's amazed that since the start of the year, there have been days without a single 911 call.
It's really quite stunning, the shift. What I heard in there was there's been a 30 to 50% reduction in calls for service, but we'll see what those numbers prove to be. But any day you have zero calls for service at that location is a miracle.
A growing volume of paramedic and police visits to the campus has been a political controversy in Anchorage. In November, the chair of the assembly proposed a measure that would fine the social service providers for excessive calls for service, a move that didn't advance very far, but angered many of those working with the city on the issue. The municipality's homeless coordinator, Nancy Burke, says the pilot program takes a different route towards addressing the same concerns. As officials assess data on what's working, they're not yet sure when the pilot will end. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Sitka is packed to the gills with visitors. That's because the Board of Fish is in town reviewing more than 100 fin fish proposals. If passed, a proposal can change the rules of the game for fishing, and one of the major battles concerns the future of the Sitka Sacro herring fishery. KCAW's Emily Kwong reports.
Sitka is the center of gravity for fish politics, at least this week. There's scientists, managers, fishermen, subsistence harvesters, all sipping coffee out of plastic cups and organizing their talking points in side rooms. I'm in one of those rooms with lifelong fisherman Eric Jordan, who says the first day is kind of like a reunion.
And you bring up old things and old battles that you fought.
And one of the biggest battles this cycle concerns waters I can see out the window. The Sitka sacro herring fishery is relatively small, but controversial. While the commercial industry harvests the eggs from inside the fish once caught, subsistence harvesters set out hemlock branches after the fleet leaves. The herrings spawn and lay their eggs. But with thinning eggs on branches, fear is escalating within Sitka Tribe of Alaska that the local stock is on the verge of collapse. On Sunday night, to honor the herring, Louise Brady and other members of the Kiksati clan organized a potlatch.
Last year, I think, made it clear that we are close to losing our herring eggs.
Brady enters the kitchen at the Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall, where Nina Vizcarando is preparing food. Opening the fridge, both are disgruntled. There's only one bowl of herring eggs to go around.
So that's the amount for today?
This is the amount for today.
For 150, 200 people.
Among them, members of the Board of Fish. Four of seven came. Israel Payton of Wasilla, Robert Ruffner of Soldotna, Al Kane of Anchorage, and Fritz Johnson of Dillingham. Johnson's advice to interest groups? He says the board likes when they all find common ground.
You know, come to, you know, compromise solutions where it seems there may be none readily available. It really enhances the process because nobody really knows local issues better than local people.
But right now, compromise is days away, and there's competing Sitka Sacro herring proposals on the table. Five call for conservation. Sitka Tribe of Alaska has put forward the biggest one, Proposal 99. It tells the board to cap the harvest rate, that's how much the fleet is allowed to catch, at 10%. Right now, Sitka uses a more generous formula than anywhere in Southeast. Proposal 98, sponsored by Andrew Tomes, calls for reducing the sliding scale even further, or setting aside herring for the ecosystem. Leave a third for the birds, he wrote in his proposal. Sitka's local advisory committee heard these cries for conservation. Amending Proposal 99, the one Sitka tribe put forward, they want the board to research what it would mean to adopt that more conservative formula used by the rest of Southeast in Sitka. Last week, the Sitka Assembly also asked the board to consider this idea. The math is tricky, but the important thing to know is that the herring fleet's quota this spring would go down from 11,000 tons to just under 7,000 tons. That means more herring in the ocean, but also millions of dollars in losses for the industry and the local economy.
Probably over $100,000 in raw fish tax, bed tax, lost electrical receipts, lost sales taxes, and a huge multiplier effect to our economy.
Steve Reifenstuhl is the executive director of the Southeast Herring Conservation Alliance, representing the fleet.
The worst thing about this move is it will not resolve the stated issue, more herring eggs on the dock.
Reifenstuhl spoke before the Sitka Assembly last week, arguing that the problem isn't overfishing, but that the annual subsistence need is too high. Calling the ANS artificially inflated, his organization has put forward Proposal 94 to substantially lower the subsistence take. They are also recommending the board reopen waters to commercial fishing while Sitka Tribe wants more waters sealed off. These battling proposals with their differing opinions on the health of the local herring stock will come to a head with 2 days of testimony. For those planning to take the microphone, Jordan has one piece of advice. Tell the Board of Fish a story.
A compelling, credible, short story from you.
And even though it's tempting to use all 3 minutes of your time, he suggests you cut it down to two. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medications prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
From one end of Alaska to the other and everywhere in between, public media works to provide quality programming and statewide news you can count on and news you can trust. Whether you're listening at home, at work, or in the car, we're grateful to be a part of your day. Thank you for tuning in.
At a sometimes tense meeting Tuesday night, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly voted down a resolution to increase efforts toward improving air quality. Fine particulate in the air caused by wood burning in the borough's Butte area has in recent years approached a threshold that, if crossed, would trigger federal regulations and costly management. A similar situation in Fairbanks has cost the borough there millions of dollars. So far, the borough has advocated for the burning of dry wood, but prior to the assembly meeting, a flyer circulated on social media suggesting the borough would someday be seizing wood stoves. Borough Manager John Moosey says that has never been part of the air quality discussion.
It was never our intention to go on your private property or remove your wood-burning stoves. We're not there.
Still, the resolution failed Tuesday, with only Assemblymember Jim Sykes voting in favor. The resolution would have allowed a memorandum of understanding between the borough and the State Department of Environmental Conservation. The MOU would have given the borough the go-ahead to, quote, implement reasonable and cost-effective strategies to assist in mitigating air pollution. Some borough residents testified they did not have enough information to support the MOU, and Assemblymember George McKee says he understands those concerns.
This is a very serious subject that should have a written, comprehensive staff analysis report. We have nothing like that. We are going to try to legislate on something that we do not have the information on.
Moosey, the borough manager, says such an analysis would itself be costly. It is unclear what the borough's next move will be in dealing with air pollution. The state just sold timber from its southeast Alaska forest to the region's largest mill. It's part of a multi-agency effort to keep the area's logging industry alive, but some say it's time to let it go. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Klooks Viking Lumber was the only buyer interested in the North Hollis timber sale. It's about 230 acres on Prince of Wales Island, the center of what's left of Southeast's timber industry. But it wasn't sold under the usual bid program. State Forester Chris Mache says it was a negotiated sale based on more than the price.
The kind of things we're looking for were the wood be used to manufacture products in the state. How many jobs, an estimated number of jobs will be created from the project. Of course, the price being offered for the timber is also a consideration.
The State Division of Forestry says Viking is paying $375,000 for mostly Sitka spruce, hemlock, and red cedar. It's not huge acreage as timber sales go, but it's one of several small state sales aimed at keeping Viking and other parts of the industry alive.
We have stepped up our timber sale program because of the shortfall of federal volume here over the last several years.
Another agency also has plans to provide stopgap timber. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Land Office is trading some controversial timberlands near cities for acreage in the Tongass National Forest. Executive Director Wynne Menefee says the office is planning for sales this year and next.
That's going to be very vital for the timber industry down there because they're short on timber supply, and we are the ones that probably can provide, after we get the land through the land exchange, the necessary fiber to market.
The first will be near Nocatee, which is also on the island. About 11,000 acres are involved, but it won't all be sold at the same time. The Tongass National Forest has been the largest source of timber on public lands for decades, but management changes, lawsuits, and a shortage of older timber has slowed its sales. Tongass officials will offer three sales this year, totaling about 1,200 acres. Spokesman Paul Robbins Jr. says two are old growth, while one is young growth.
We're also working on environmental impact statements for sales on the Petersburg and Wrangell Ranger districts, as well as multiple sales as part of the Prince of Wales landscape level analysis.
They just want to continue to do business the way they have been doing business.
Bob Claus is a Prince of Wales Island resident and a member of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. He questions sales that continue supplying old-growth timber to what he calls a dying industry. He says they're damaging the environment, including salmon, deer, and wolf habitat.
So you have Sea Alaska, you have Mental Health Trust, you have State Lands, and you have the Forest Service all selling or all pushing for more old-growth harvest out of a place that just can't take it anymore. They've already taken all the old growth that they can take, and probably more than was acceptable.
Viking Lumber continues logging old growth trees from a previous Forest Service sale. What's called Big Thorn involves about 6,000 acres between Thorn Bay and Kaufman Cove. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
The world's tightest house is on the market in Dillingham. KDLG's Liam Wright reports.
Tom Marsick is an associate professor of sustainable energy at the UAF Bristol Bay campus and is a passionate advocate for reducing use of non-renewable energy like fossil fuels. He and his wife, Kristen Donaldson, put that passion to work when they decided to build their own home in 2011.
And I have been, of course, in my position teaching people about how to build efficient homes. And now here I was building a home. I didn't want to be hypocritical, so I thought, well, I might as well build a home that's aligned with what I have been preaching.
The 600-square-foot house on Gothier Way has two bedrooms and one bath. The 28-inch thick walls are stuffed with insulation and a vapor barrier to keep the heat in. Most of the heat comes from passive solar gain and byproduct heat from appliances and bodies inside. Marsick says he didn't initially set out to break an efficiency record, but when they performed a blower door test to measure the house's airflow, the rating that came up was lower than anybody had ever heard of. They contacted the World Record Academy in 2013, and after another blower door test monitored by third-party witnesses, the house was officially dubbed as the world's most airtight residential building. The family has now put the house on the market because Marsick is leaving Dillingham for work at the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, a joint appointment with UAF. Marsick has always welcomed students and visitors in for explanatory tours, something that he hopes continues in the future.
It would be great if the new owner was something who would want to be there involved in education. It would be great. But even if not, if it's just a person who lives there and who shares the same value, by that nature, it will continue to be an educational tool. Because knowing that the house continues to exist, the community will know about that, and it will continue serving as an educational tool informally that way.
Marsick estimates the actual energy used to heat the home is about the equivalent of 35 gallons of oil. The house has been on the market for a few months at a recently lowered asking price of $299,000. In Dillingham, I'm Liam Wright.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Casey Grove, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney, Ed Schoenfeld, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Liam Wright in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. You can nominate your favorite teacher at bpteachers.com. The deadline is February 1st. Did you know while exposed to secondhand smoke, every breath you take can damage your heart? Cells lining blood vessels become swollen and inflamed. Plaque builds narrowing blood vessels, and clots can form, robbing the heart of oxygen. Exposure to secondhand smoke increases your heart disease risk by up to 30%. It's your heart protected. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline, 1-800-QUIT-NOW.
One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.